Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good afternoon.
I'm Chris Higashi, the program manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the library's Beacon Hill branch and today's event with Karen Thompson Walker, whom we are thrilled to host. So we first thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present today's event, to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, to our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. The foundation represents thousands of people in our community who give gifts large and small to support our libraries. That private support is what makes possible so many of our free library programs. So foundation donors here with us today, we say thanks very much for your support. Let's see, so I guess now I'll just turn things over to Rick Simonson from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thanks very much.
I just want to say, for Elliott Bay, thank you very much for being here today. We are delighted, and as Chris said, thrilled to have Karen here for this book that's come out this year, her novel, The Age of Miracles. And I think Karen, who's worked as an editor in the book trade, can even say, knowing how books, the process by which books are written, which takes its own skill and artistry, and then all the crazy stuff that often goes into making the book into the world, getting it into the world. All this, you for all the great enthusiasms, it often feels like more things work against things happening in a good way than the good things happening. And it's been a wonderful thing that a book as wonderful as her novel, The Age of Miracles, is that things are happening. And it's a book that, for those of you who don't know, because it is a book that already many people have been getting, it's a remarkable coming-of-age story of a young girl in Southern California. And coming of age into adolescence is a stepping into a world that seems to be changing and shifting, and you're trying to assert and learn what your part in the world will be, and that includes the way the world seems to change from how you viewed it as a child. And in this case, the world has shifted, and in ways that that she writes of, this sort of wonderful, the narrative voice is part of what makes this book particularly special and distinct, because it carries this sort of still that young perception, and that's learning to know, and yet what can't, and even the adults don't know it. So it's and the change and how society starts breaking, the various forms of things breaking it out and changing. It's a wonderful book, and again, part of the nice thing is it's the word of it is beginning to happen. The reviews are greatly highly praising, and now the word of mouth is, which is really how books live and get carried around. So again, for both the Seattle Public Library and the Library Foundation and Elliott Bay, thank you for being here, and now please join in welcoming Karen Thompson Walker.
Thank you. Thank you to Seattle Public Library and Elliott Bay Books. I'm just really excited to be here. And thank you. I'm so glad that there's so many familiar friends and family here. Thank you for coming. But you know, I feel like one of the amazing things about being on this book tour has been, one, the chance to see all these, friends and family from each place we go. There's like, here we have an especially large group, which is amazing. But each place there's been, at least a few people we know. So that has been really wonderful. But I also think, in a way, just sort of every bit as exciting is to see people that I don't know yet, come to hear me talk about my book. It just feels really amazing. And it's one of those things that reminds you that writing a book is sort of a form of communication. You put it out into the world and people hear it. It's just really nice. So thank you. Thanks to the people who I know and who I don't know yet. Thank you for coming. So I'll just tell you a little bit about the book, and then I'll read a couple short sections. And I really would love to answer questions afterwards, so please just ask away at the end. So this is a book that is about a young girl who and her family who wake up one morning, along with the rest of the world, to some really extraordinary news and alarming news. And the news is that the rotation of the Earth has suddenly started to slow down. And so the book is about the unfolding of this strange, unexpected catastrophe and how it affects, you know, the planet and the people of the planet. But it also is just as much a story about growing up, because Julia, the young girl at the center of the story, and the adult version of Julia is narrating the story about her childhood when this happened. Even though there's this large catastrophe unfolding, it unfolds at a rate that kind of allows for the continuation of a certain amount of ordinary life, even though it's off kilter. So that part, that is the part about Julia growing up in this altered world, but yet a lot of things remain the same. So it's really about both the small-scale disasters of adolescence as well as, obviously, this very large-scale disaster. So I've noticed that a lot of times when people hear what the premise is about the slowing of the rotation of the Earth, they are curious, you know, where I got the idea. And so I got this idea from something that really happened. That was back in 2004. I read a newspaper article that said that it was right after the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia. I read that earthquake also, it was so powerful that it also affected the rotation of the Earth. And the result was that after that, our days were a few microseconds shorter instead of the normal 24-hour day, 24 hours. And when I read that, I didn't know that that was possible, and it was just one of those things that just seemed incredibly haunting to me, that something that I always thought that I'd obviously taken for granted, you know, the steady and predictable rising and setting of the sun, the idea that that was actually in flux, even if it was just a tiny amount, was, you know, haunting. And I was in graduate school at the time for creative writing. I was working on short stories. So I decided, you know, I heard that news and I thought right away, you know, what would happen to us and to the planet if a much larger change in the rotation ever happened. So that was the first kernel, and I wrote it as a short story, and it was kind of an experiment. If I had known then that story would be my first novel, I would have been really shocked, because, you know, it was 14 pages long, and I had never written anything that kind of played with the rules of reality in this way. So it's been kind of a surprising, although a slow motion surprise, that this turned out to be my first novel. So I wrote as a short story, and I set it aside for a couple of years, and I kept writing, but I was writing other short stories, and I started working in book publishing. And it was when I was an editorial assistant, which is sort of the starting point to becoming an editor, that I came back to this short story, 14-page short story. And for some reason, this time, after a few years had gone by, I felt like maybe there was more to the story, and maybe it could be a novel. And I didn't know if I could write it. I really felt strongly like I could imagine reading this novel, and I wish I could read it. So maybe I'll try to write it. And so I started working, and it turned out to be, once I started thinking of it in that way, it did turn out to be sort of, I mean, there was a lot of major challenges, but I was surprised by, it felt like after years of thinking about how you might write a novel and what kind of story could make for a novel, it felt a little sudden after years of thinking. Then suddenly I thought, oh, maybe this will work. And I was kind of surprised when I hit like 30 pages or 50 pages, because I'd never written anything longer than like 18 before that. So the only problem was when I went back, as I mentioned, I had this full-time job as an editorial assistant. So now that I had an idea that I felt like maybe could be a novel, I didn't really have, you know, what felt like the right amount of time to work on it. So this is really a novel that was written kind of hour by hour in the mornings before I went to work. So I would wake up a little early and, you know, do a small amount of work on my novel and then go to work and help other people make their books better. So it was hard to have that time pressure, and it sometimes felt excruciatingly slow. It took me about 4 years of working that way. But, you know, in the end, I did finally get to the end. And I know that that job, working in book publishing, especially just the editorial part of it, helped me. I learned a lot about storytelling as I was learning to become an editor. So I think it actually was great for my writing, but it did feel slow as I wrote. So that's sort of how the book came to be. I'm going to read the opening, the first couple pages, and then talk a little bit more about how it got here. Let's see if I can. One, we didn't notice right away. We couldn't feel it. We did not sense at first the extra time bulging from the smooth edge of each day like a tumor blooming beneath skin. We were distracted back then by weather and war. We had no interest in the turning of the earth. Bombs continued to explode on the streets of distant countries. Hurricanes came and went. Summer ended. A new school year began. The clocks ticked as usual. Seconds beaded into minutes. Minutes grew into hours, and there was nothing to suggest that those hours, too, were not still pooling into days, each the same fixed length known to every human being. But there were those who would later claim to have recognized the disaster before the rest of us did. These were the night workers, the graveyard shifters, the stockers of shelves and the loaders of ships, the drivers of big rig trucks, or else they were the bearers of different burdens, the sleepless, and the troubled, and the sick. These people were accustomed to waiting out the night. Through bloodshot eyes, a few did detect a certain persistence of darkness on the mornings leading up to the news, but each mistook it for the private misperception of a lonely, rattled mind. On the 6th of October, the experts went public. This, of course, is the day we all remember. There'd been a change, they said, a slowing. And that's what we called it from then on, the slowing. We have no way of knowing if this trend will continue, said a shy, bearded scientist at a hastily arranged press conference, now infamous. He cleared his throat and swallowed. Cameras flashed in his eyes. Then came the moment, replayed so often afterward, that the particular cadences of that scientist's speech, the dips and the pauses and that slight Midwestern slant, would be forever married to the news itself. He went on, but we suspect that it will continue. Our days had grown by 56 minutes in the night. At the beginning, people stood on street corners and shouted about the end of the world. Counselors came to talk to us at school. I remember watching Mr. Valencia next door fill up his garage with stacks of canned food and bottled water, as if preparing, it now seems to me, for a disaster much more minor. The grocery stores were soon empty. The shelves sucked clean like chicken bones. The freeways clogged immediately. People heard the news and they wanted to move. Families piled into minivans and crossed state lines. They scurried in every direction like small animals caught suddenly under a light. But of course, there was nowhere on earth to go. Two. The news broke on a Saturday. In our house, at least, the change had gone unnoticed. We were still asleep when the sun came up that morning, so we sensed nothing unusual in the timing of its rise. Those last few hours, before we learned of the slowing, remain preserved in my memory, even all these years later, as if trapped behind glass. My friend Hannah had slept over the night before, and we'd camped out in sleeping bags on the living room floor, where we'd slept side by side on 100 other nights. We woke to the purring of lawnmower motors and the barking of dogs, to the soft squeak of a trampoline as the twins jumped next door. In an hour, we'd both be dressed in blue soccer uniforms, hair pulled back, sunscreen applied, cleats clicking on tile. "I had the weirdest dream last night," said Hannah. She lay on her stomach, her head propped up on one elbow, her long blonde hair hanging tangled behind her ears. She had a certain skinny beauty that I wished I had, too. "You always have weird dreams," I said. She unzipped her sleeping bag and sat up, pressed her knees to her chest. From her slim wrist, there jingled a charm bracelet, crowded with charms. Among them, one half of a small brass heart, the other half of which belonged to me. In the dream, she said, I was at my house, but it wasn't my house. I was with my mom, but she wasn't my mom. My sisters weren't my sisters. I hardly ever remember my dreams, I said. Then I got up to let the cats out of the garage. My parents were spending that morning the way I remember them spending every morning, reading the newspaper at the dining room table. I can still see them sitting there, my mother in her green bathrobe, her hair wet, skimming quickly through the pages, while my father sat in silence, fully dressed, reading every story in the order it appeared, each one reflected in the thick lenses of his glasses. My father would save that day's paper for a long time afterward, packed away like an heirloom, folded neatly beside the newspaper from the day I was born. The pages of that Saturday's paper, printed before the news was out, report a rise in the city's real estate prices, the further erosion of several area beaches, and plans for a new freeway overpass. That week, a local surfer had been attacked by a great white shark. Border Patrol agents discovered a 3-mile-long drug-running tunnel 6 feet beneath the U.S.-Mexico border, and the body of a young girl, long missing, was found buried under a pile of white rocks in the wide, empty desert out east. The times of that day's sunrise and sunset appear in a chart on the back page, predictions that did not, of course, come to pass. Half an hour before we heard the news, my mother went out for bagels. I think the cat sensed the change before we did. They were both Siamese, but different breeds. Chloe was sleepy and feathery and sweet. Tony was her opposite, an old and anxious creature, possibly mentally ill, a cat who tore out his own fur in snatches and left it in piles around the house, tiny tumbleweeds set adrift on the carpet. In those last few minutes, as I ladled dry food into their bowls, the ears of both cats began to swivel wildly toward the front yard. Maybe they felt it somehow, a shift in the air. They both knew the sound of my mother's Volvo pulling into the driveway, but I wondered later if they recognized also the unusually quick spin of the wheels as she rushed to park the car, or the panic in the sharp crack of the parking brake as she yanked it into place. Soon, even I could detect the pitch of my mother's mood. From the stomps of her feet on the porch, the disorganized rattle of her keys against the door. She had heard those earliest news reports, now notorious, on the car radio between the bagel shop and home. Turn on the TV right now, she said. She was breathless and sweaty. She left her keys in the teeth of the lock where they would dangle all day. She went on, something god-awful is happening. So that's the opening. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. So I was really excited about the idea when I first got the idea, you know, what if I write a novel in which the rotation of the Earth is slowing down? But I'm not a scientist. I've always loved to read about science, but I don't have, I'm not trained in science. So I knew that one of the hardest things about writing the book, and it was to figure out what would happen, especially, you know, to the Earth, but also to plants and animals and to us if such a major change were to ever take place. So I did research as I went, because I really did want I wanted the science to feel as real as possible and as real as the characters in the story. It certainly takes a certain imaginative leap, and I knew that from the beginning, but I wanted it to feel convincing as you read it, because nothing bothers me more when I'm reading a novel if I don't believe that what I'm reading during the time that I'm reading it is real. You know, I want it to feel like a true story. So that was my goal. And I mostly was sort of self-taught in my research into, you know, the physics of it, but also the biology and ecology of it. And the reason that I didn't show it to an expert too soon, like while I was still writing it, is because I just, maybe from working in book publishing, I just was extra aware of how hard it is to publish a novel, for anyone to publish a novel, and especially your first novel. And so I didn't want to bother a real scientist doing real scientific work with something that I was just making up and which might never leave my laptop. But after I sold it, I did show it to an astrophysicist who turned out to be just a really wonderful reader, because he was, you know, a lover of fiction, but also had this obviously astrophysics expertise. So in general, I mean, the whole experience of that was really fascinating, although nerve-wracking before I heard from him. But he, in general, I was just really relieved by his response and by how much of it he felt was, once you take this big leap, that something we don't expect to happen has happened. I was relieved by how much of it he felt was plausible and based in real science. And then he crucially helped me fix a few things to make them more realistic. So he was, a crucial reader. And then I guess one of the things that I didn't have to do any research on was the setting. And it's set in Southern California. And the setting was really important to me as I wrote the book. It was a real pleasure to write about just the landscape of California and what it feels like to live there. And it was an obvious choice for me because I grew up in California. And so, as I said, Julia, the main character, is 11 years old. And so it made sense for me to write, to imagine the life of an 11-year-old girl living in the place where I lived when I was 11. So in general, I tried to draw not so much on the events of my childhood, because my childhood was a lot more less turbulent than the one in the book. But I did try to draw on just the feelings, both of my feelings about California and just what it's like to live there, and also the feelings of what it's like to be in middle school, and just how sensitive everyone is, and especially girls. And so I tried to just, draw on those memories. But California really, it really is, in my mind, almost like a character in the book. And as I wrote the book, I realized that it wasn't, because it was a convenient choice to me to set it in California, but as I wrote the book, I felt like there's something maybe more profound about setting it there. And I think that if I hadn't grown up in California, a place where you're aware from a really young age the power of natural disaster, and you're taught at school how to, how to protect yourself if there is an earthquake, and often you see, smoke in the sky from brush fires. So that awareness of natural disaster was scary when I was young. Like I said, we did earthquake drills, or at the beginning of every school year, we would pack like an earthquake kit, and it was consisted of each student packed 3 days worth of non-perishable food into a Ziploc bag, and then that would like sit in the closet for the year, and that food was the food that we would eat if there was ever a huge earthquake that was so powerful that it stranded us at school. We could just stay at school eating that food for 3 days, and that scared me a lot. I mean, the way that I'm describing it is probably not the way the teachers described it to us. But I imagined it, like, what kind of situation would it be that my parents couldn't get to me for 3 days? That was a frightening, it was frightening to imagine that. But the thing that I think, as an adult, when I look back on my childhood in California, the thing that's even more striking is actually, even though that was a part of life, really, obviously, you don't think about it most days. It's obviously ordinary life goes on. It's obviously a really pleasant place to live most of the time. And so that combination of how you can live in a place where, in theory, a huge natural disaster could change your life, but at the same time, most days you don't think about it even once. That combination just seemed very endearing to me, and maybe is sort of a metaphor for how everyone's life is. We all just assume that our days are going to be ordinary and that we'll, live normal, long lives, but you never know when your life could change suddenly. But for me, I thought a lot about California and what it was like to grow up there as I tried to imagine how the people in my book would respond to and adapt to an even, much larger catastrophe than the big one. In the slowing of the rotation of the Earth. So I think growing up in California was just kind of a major important key to writing this particular novel for me, even though now I live in New York, so I've been away for a while. But I would love to sort of keep setting books there. We'll see. So now I'm going to read a later section. One thing that you need to know is that... So as there's a lot of consequences, as you can imagine, once the rotation of the Earth starts to slow down. The first thing that happens is that the 24-hour clock no longer corresponds to the time it takes for the Earth to turn once. So the days are 25 hours, 26 hours, and they just kept getting longer and longer and fall completely out of sync with our 24-hour clock. But then also there's a lot of natural consequences, you know, on plants and animals and humans. And one of the first things that happens is that, and scientists don't always understand why exactly everything is happening, but it's obviously related to the slowing. So the first thing that happens in that sense is that birds begin to fall from the sky all over the world. And then later, whales begin to beach themselves also around the world. So this section I'm going to read now is about the whales. And the other thing you need to know, it's also, you know, very much about Julia, the young girl, the main character, and a boy named Seth, who she has sort of formed a new bond with after a period of a lot of loneliness for Julia, of the kind of middle school variety. But now she has this new friend, Seth. And they go to see the whales together in this scene. Seth knew a shortcut through the canyon to the beach. It was a steep and sandy trail littered with pine cones and shaded by limestone bluffs. The smell of the canyon was the same as ever, like soil and sage. But the colors of California were turning starker. All the greens were fading away. Most everything was dying. Still, the canyon buzzed with beetles and mosquitoes and flies. Whatever the birds had once eaten was flourishing, unhunted. "Watch out for snakes," said Seth. I liked the way he walked, loose and unhurried, a boy who knew his way. I was the girl walking with him, so I walked that way too. The trail swung around a corner, and the beach came into view. It was low tide, lower than I'd ever seen it. The slowing was throwing off all the tides. Hundreds of feet of seafloor lay exposed, the sand ribboned black with bits of iron. These were the ocean's insides, revealed. We stopped on the trail for a moment, watching the ocean, side by side, our hands so close they almost touched. We crossed the coast road, ducked beneath the caution tape, and cut through the space between two ruined mansions, wet from the last high tide. One house had collapsed like a cake. Its walls were lined with barnacles. Sea anemones carpeted the front steps. I bent to take off my shoes. "Look," said Seth. And there they were, the whales, dark and still, prehistoric in size. A small crowd of people had gathered on the beach. Good Samaritans were dumping salt water on the whales. Other volunteers were returning from the distant high tide, swaying with buckets full of fresh seawater. We could hear the whales breathing, a slow rising and falling. We listened, we watched. They were social creatures, the whole group distressed by the stress of any one individual. It was obvious they were dying, but we couldn't help it. We were mesmerized. Seth picked up two empty plastic cups from the sand, bits of ancient litter. He handed one to me. "We have to do something," he said. "Come on." We ran barefoot down to the water, cups in hand. It was a long run. The mud sucked our feet. Creatures slithered unseen beneath my toes. Dead fish sparkled in the sun as my hair whipped in the wind. When we reached the lapping water and looked back, the humans on the beach were barely visible. Their hairline arms and hairline legs fluttered soundlessly around the whales. The only noise was the churning of the ocean. We rushed to fill our cups with water and then ran back across the thick band of mud. We looked for the driest whale, the one most in need. We found it at the edge of the group, and we imagined that it was older than the others. Its skin was striped white with scars. I shooed flies from its eyes, one eye at a time. Seth poured our meager water supply over its head and into its mouth. He petted its side. I felt an urgency, like love. "Hey, kid," someone called from behind us. It was a man in a beach hat, an empty white bucket swinging from one hand. A gust of wind drowned out what he said, so he shouted it again. "That one's already dead." We were solemn as we climbed back up through the canyon. We were hot and exhausted. It was the 23rd hour of daylight. The sun showed no signs of sinking. "It's the magnetic field that's doing it," said Seth. "What is?" I said. A strong wind blew through the canyon, kicking up dust and dried leaves. "That's why the whales are beaching themselves," he said. "They use the magnetic field for navigation, and now it's decaying because of the slowing." I glanced at the sky, a smooth, unblemished blue. "You can't see it," Seth said. "It's invisible." Those were only the first of the whales. Hundreds more would soon wash ashore on the California coastline, then thousands, tens of thousands, more. Eventually, people stopped trying to save them. "It's not just the whales who need the magnetic field," said Seth, as we arrived at the edge of the canyon and took our first steps on paved ground. "We need it too," he said. "My dad says that all the humans would die without it." But that day, I could hardly hear him. My mind was elsewhere. I was a little bit in love. I'd spent an entire afternoon with Seth Moreno. Thank you. Thanks. So I really would be happy to answer any questions if you have any. I'm not writing a sequel, but I am working on a new book, which is a different situation, but it is, and I'm early, it's early stages, but it's about a different extreme situation, but a different kind. No one has asked me that question yet. Well, my mom had a Volvo when I was growing up, so it was a quick and easy choice, and also, you know, the mother in the book is very concerned and worried. She's a worrier, so I thought a Volvo is known as like a safe car that she would choose. Did you? I think the one thing that I realized as I was writing the book is that I think kids, at least if you're the kind of kid who spends a lot of time outside, you're like really aware of the natural landscape in a way that I hadn't thought that much about. Like, I know the names of all the plants and stuff that I grew up around, even though now I've lived in, of course, I live in a city. That might be part of the problem, but I've lived in New York for 9 years, and there's not one plant that I can think of that I learned that I would associate with the East Coast. But I think it's because as a kid, you're like in the grass and picking flowers and making things out of all the plant, you know, and spending time in the canyons. I mean, at least if you're in California. But I'm glad that it rang true for you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, to me, of course, I had come up with this premise that's not very. It's not likely at all. I mean, it's extremely unlikely. But so as soon as I started writing about it, I felt like I knew that I wasn't going to try to explain the cause because, you know, right now in 2012, an astrophysicist wouldn't be able to tell you why the rotation of the Earth would suddenly slow down by an hour, 2 hours. So they don't expect that to happen. And so I'm not going to come up with a reason for, you know, an explanation in the book for why it happened. So it was partly just, it was practical to do that. But the more I wrote the book, the more I felt like, I mean, it does reflect a feeling I have about science. I love science, and I think it's the best way we have to try to understand like the physical reality of our world. But I do think sometimes we kind of assume that we, just because science hasn't figured something out, we assume that like that it's not a mystery, but just that we understand it. Like, you know, we assume. So, for example, in this scenario, I liked the idea of writing about something that we didn't expect, and I feel like maybe some people would think just because scientists can't think of a reason based on our current level of knowledge that this would happen, then that it can't. And I feel like there's maybe more to the Earth and the universe that we haven't figured out yet, and maybe we will someday. But I liked the idea of writing about something. It felt realistic to me that scientists wouldn't be able to figure it out in a short amount of time, that they might have to study it for 30 years, 50 years, even more. You know, there's still mysteries about how, especially places that we can't visit, like the center of the Earth, scientists don't know everything about how it works and what's happening in there. So yeah, it was intentional for a practical reason, but maybe also a little bit like a philosophical thing, that it just seemed true that we wouldn't be able to understand something so big and unexpected. Quickly, at least. you and then maybe you. So I I found the astrophysicist through my work. You know, since I worked at a book publishing house, one of my colleagues, an editor, had an author that he worked with who was an astrophysicist and wrote books. But so he had like a young graduate student that he recommended, and I think he might have recommended him because not only was he's like a Johns Hopkins PhD student in astrophysics, so he's obviously really smart and knows his stuff, but he also was a fan of fiction, so he was really the perfect reader. And the main thing that he helped me fix was that I had misunderstood, from my research, I had misunderstood how the slowing down of the Earth's rotation would affect gravity as we experience it. And I thought that it would be slightly weaker, but really it's the opposite, and it's ever so slightly stronger. So that was the main thing that I changed. And then there was a few times I would just, you know, like a phrase that I would say something that he's like, well, that's actually not exactly right. But those were mostly small things. And he also, interestingly, said the whole time he was reading it, he was just hoping I wasn't going to explain why. So I felt glad that I had made that decision, because he was like, things happen all the time that we don't then we try to figure out why it's happening, you know, when it takes. So I felt glad that we ended up being on the same page about that, even though I didn't, you know, that was at the end when I already had a full draft. I feel like there was one more question the history. Well, I know that the Earth is over time, it's been gradually slowing, the rotation of the Earth is slowing down, but over billions of years. So I knew, I didn't do like a ton of research about that, because what I really would have wanted to research was how did human beings respond, you know, when we had a different length of day, but that was pre-humans. But that is happening over the course of history, that we're slowly, the rotation of the Earth is slowly slowing down. Oh, did I think you had? Not in the final draft. I mean, I felt like, especially the biological consequences, that I felt even more. I'll back up and say, in general, I felt like a lot of creative freedom, because nobody knows exactly what would happen. Of course, astrophysicists and biologists, people who, you know, if they studied it, could give would have a good theory of what would happen, but nobody knows what's going to happen. And also, I don't think it's not a source of major study, because we're not expecting that to happen. So I felt like a certain amount of freedom, because we don't know exactly what would happen. And then with things like the birds suffer a mysterious syndrome that scientists can't quite pinpoint what it is, why it's happening. Although it's definitely related to the slowing, and again, I felt like that happens in our real world. Like in general, I tried to learn as much as I could from what happens here in our real world with the rotation staying at the same rate. So I felt like, you know, sometimes, I mean, that sometimes happens to birds, that there's mass birds die-offs, or the colony collapse disorder of bees that we don't quite understand why that's happening. And so I felt with specific consequences like that, I felt a certain amount of freedom, especially because, again, like often the scientists they can't quite keep up with how fast, in my book, how fast things are changing. When I wrote the book, I was just imagining readers like me. That's kind of the way I write. I try to write in a way that I, as a reader, would want to read, you know, whatever I would want to read. So that's how I think of it when I'm writing. So, you know, in that way, I was thinking of adults, but I do love stories about childhood, and my favorite ones tend to be the ones that have where the narrator is an adult. So in this book, the narrator is an adult, but she's looking, you know, in very close detail back at her childhood. But I like that combination, because then it allows for, of course, it's very much about the life of a young girl, but you can have the perspective and like the use of language and stuff that an adult would have in telling their story. But definitely there's been, people have been curious about, you know, if maybe young adult readers would like it. And I have heard from a few parents who've said that their like 11 to 18 year olds have responded to it. So that is really exciting. I mean, I'm happy to have readers of all ages. And I'm also curious, to hear if they think it still feels, if it feels authentic to them, you know, if it feels someone who is 11, does it feel like the girl really is 11? Uh-huh. I feel like some of the things that happened to Julia would have been like my worst fears when I was 11 or 12. You know what I mean? Like worried that I'm going to stand out or someone will like make a joke. But then mostly in my life, that didn't, I might see it happen to other people more than it happened to me. But for Julia, I tried to, you know, imagine what if it really did happen that way. And I tried to use my memory of what it felt like and what my worries were when I was that age. And I don't, for some reason, I remember that age in my own life better than a lot of other older ages. Like, I remember it much better than high school. I don't know why, especially the details of how I felt about things. So I just tried to use that. Oh, that's a good but a big question. I always wanted to be a writer since I was a child. I mean, I didn't always know, like, I want to grow up and write books, but I always liked to write, and it was always the thing that I was best at in school. And actually, recently, my parents came across this, like, old evaluation that was done of me when I was 2 years old, and it was really weird and fascinating to read because some of the things, a lot of the same like qualities, both in my personality but also as a writer, it seemed like were already mentioned in this psychological evaluation. Like, I mean, just in a really quick way, but it said like that I was especially adept at use of language, and it's obviously for a two-year-old, but it still was weird that that's still the thing that is the thing that I know that is my stronger, that I'm stronger at than anything else, and also that I had an unusual like level of ability to concentrate for a two-year-old. You know, like that it's like she sits with her task in mind for like long periods of time while she tries to solve it or whatever. And when I read that, whatever the phrase was, I was like, that sounds like me this morning when I was trying to write my new book. So it was kind of weird but fascinating to think that. I mean, I think some of it is just there, you know, early. But I did get a lot more serious about specifically writing fiction when I got to college, and I took some really great creative writing classes and had really good mentors. So that's when I got more serious about it, and then spent like my whole 20s trying to figure out how to do it. Uh-huh. Well, I guess the biggest change is that I ended up, for a while I was still I sold my book, and then I tried to, for a while, continue to be an editor and write my new book, but it started to seem, it was a little bit hard to balance and just too tempting to try writing full time. So that's the biggest change for me, that I'm able to kind of, at least for now, set my life up around writing. So that was a big change. And then the other big change is just, you know, the idea that to have readers is really a big change, you know, because I was writing for a long time, and I had my husband and a few close friends who are writers who would read my work, but, you know, I feel like not more than, you know, five people had read this book for years. You know, I was around for years, and five people had read parts of it, and so then to suddenly have a lot more than that is really kind of, like, surreal, but amazing, obviously. So that's a big change. Jan? I think they realized early that I was not going to be an engineer. I don't think that was early. Maybe it was a little bit later, especially my dad. It took longer to realize I wasn't going to, like, go into business. That maybe, you know, like, marketing or something practical, like, you know, or accounting, like something, you know, something else like that. I definitely think he thought that I was, like, especially like I went to get an MFA in writing, and then I went into book publishing, and I was trying to, and I was writing on the side, and I think he definitely thought I was like, kind of, you know, doing this impractical thing, you know, but kind of like the older I get, the more I appreciate their response, because at the time I sort of like, he would be like, well, you could, it's still not too late, you could go back and get an MBA, you know, and that felt like a little bit annoying, but actually when I think about it, you know, as I get older, I actually really appreciate it, because that's about it. That was the extent of his attempt. He would just be like, well, let me know. Like, he would just make one comment once in a while. And, I mean, really, my parents, you know, helped me, you know, go to get my MFA at Columbia. Like, even as they thought they weren't quite sure that it was the greatest, most practical idea, they were still, like, you know, paying my rent. So I feel like the fact that they they really did support and encourage me, even though they were a little worried about it, is kind of, I think, it's endearing to me. But now, of course, they're really excited, so. Let's see, there's two books that I really love that maybe especially were relevant to writing this book, and that would be The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which is also an end-of-the-world story, but it had really beautifully written in a way that and also really, like, about, like, the relationships between people in a way that I thought was really moving. Another one is Blindness by Jose Saramago, which is about a city that suddenly almost everyone goes blind within a few weeks, and, you know, chaos follows. But those are two of my favorites. They're kind of, you know, were influential when writing this book. But then other of my favorites are Jhumpa Lahiri, especially her short stories. I think I really learned something about how to craft a story from reading her short stories. And also Jeffrey Eugenides. Those are probably the ones that are kind of on my mind the most. If anyone else have questions? Okay. Another reason that I liked the fact that I was writing about a young girl is that it still is, even though there is this really frightening thing happening, as you know, and no one knows if the Earth will survive or if humanity will survive, it still is also about, like, the highs and lows of, you know, the ordinary journey of a young girl, and that there was, like, for me, a brightness to that. And also, writing the book, I realized something, which I think is maybe why, is one reason that I'm drawn to apocalyptic stories in general, which is that it was really, like, moving to write about all the things that I, you know, with reverence, all the things that I love about just, you know, every ordinary thing about life, you know, and life, especially, you know, on our planet, and the fact that there are birds. So that I wrote the scenes about how birds were falling from the sky, and I think ever since I wrote that, I do feel a little sometimes when I see birds fly, it's like, feels like kind of amazing that we live someplace where, you know, some creatures can fly, like little, so there's, it, in a weird way, writing about those things falling away in fiction had a way of making me kind of appreciate all the things that we have in our real life. Also, it's not going to happen. This isn't going to happen. Yeah, I mean, I didn't, I got this idea, and I just, I really wanted to just write a real story about real people going through this unimaginable change. So that was where my mind was as I wrote the book. But I did try to learn as much as I could from our real world. And obviously one thing that I learned a lot from was just watching, you know, hearing reports about climate change and the debates around them and how different people react in different ways, particularly because it is a slow motion change. So definitely sort of studying and learning about climate change, I'm sure it, I mean, consciously and probably unconsciously, helped me try to write about this different slow motion catastrophe. Although I purposely didn't want to write about that one because I wanted it to be like a real story about real people and not like a political allegory. You know, I wanted it to feel like its own thing. But I definitely, you know, looked to climate change and the way people think about it to try to understand how people would think about this other kind of change. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming. It's really great questions. Thanks.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.